This is an ABC podcast.
Remember when you were a kid and you got your head stuck through some bars and you couldn't get it out? Yep.
Huge disruption to world trade as a grounded container ship closes the Suez Canal.
The ship is massive. It's absolutely huge. And I think this is what's complicating rescue efforts.
It really is massive. More than 400 metres long and a quarter of a billion tonnes. And it's stuck. Hello. This is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy, and yes, it's the old story of a ship in a bottleneck. The Ever Given became wedged a day or so ago in the Suez Canal. Elizabeth Jackson from Curtin University is a global supply chain expert, and what she makes clear is that the problem isn't so much what has happened as where it's happened.
Richard, the Suez Canal is one of the main waterways in the world. The Suez Canal in 2020 put through about 19,000 ships, about 1.17 billion tonnes, and it accounts for about 12% of world trade and about 30% of global container ship traffic.
Wow. So, but given that, I mean, it's not just a big ditch with water in it. It would be a sophisticated piece of infrastructure. How has this happened?
The Suez Canal is not only a sophisticated piece of engineering and infrastructure, but it's an extremely sophisticated example of technology as well, and the technology that goes into planning and actually keeping this flow of goods going through the Suez Canal is absolutely fascinating. It's extremely advanced. How this happened, despite the advancements of what the international maritime trade has at its fingertips, this happened because of Mother Nature. Mother Nature put on a big dust storm and put up extremely big winds, and the consequence was the Ever Given running aground.
The pictures are extraordinary. It looks like someone's tried to park in a space that's really not big enough and now can't move either way. Why can't the Suez Canal just get some tugs in there to give it a bit of a nudge and get it out?
They are trying. They are trying very, very, very hard. They've had tugs in there, pushing their little hearts out, trying to shift this vessel. I believe that they are restricted in themselves with weather conditions at present, which is making their life very, very, very difficult.
All right. So what are the consequences? Do we know how many vessels are backed up?
I believe that there are about 100 vessels backed up in front of the Ever Given and behind the Ever Given as well. So a total, I should say, of about 100 ships. The consequences are very interesting. We have some supply chain specialists who are saying, don't panic. Congestion at ports is something that we're interested in and we live with on a daily basis, and there are other problems that can go wrong in supply chains. But what we have actually seen is we've seen oil prices go up 5 or 6%, well, 5.9% since...
Already? Gosh.
Already, yes, since this has happened. But, oil prices are particularly sensitive. Given that so much oil does go through the Suez Canal, I believe that it's about 1 million barrels a day.
Right.
It's very, very, very sensitive to what's happening.
I'd imagine, Elizabeth, that the shipping lines with vessels sort of in this queue at the moment, they would be hoping that this is resolved very quickly. Obviously, it's going to be very expensive otherwise. Because if it's not, they really have a bit of a dilemma, don't they, as to what they should do?
Yes. Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how this situation plays out, because I believe that the vessel is still immobile. It is still run aground despite the efforts and activities of the last 48 hours. So what the Suez Canal Authority has actually done is, because of the severity of the situation, the canal has actually opened an older canal that is allowing ships to go through, keeping that flow going. the alternatives of turning around and going somewhere else aren't that great. So there's some, so there's be some very interesting decision making going to play out over the next couple of days as to what shipping companies are going to do, whether they're going to try and sit and wait it out or they're going to make the decision to send vessels elsewhere.
I'm wondering, Elizabeth, I mean, you're an expert in supply chains, and I'm just wondering what this is going to do to global supply chains. We already know that there's big delays in lots of ports, just in our region, places like Chittagong and Colombo, but others as well. There's too many empty containers in some places and not enough in others. How is this going to... Well, it's not going to make it better, is it?
Absolutely not. Well, the first topic we've covered off on already is the price of petrol. So even though the price of crude oil has gone up about 5.9% over the last, you know, in the last 24, 48 hours, let's just see what happens to our price of petrol in Australia. The other thing to keep in mind in terms of how it's going to affect us in Australia, we're in a pretty lucky situation, believe it or not, because about two-thirds of Australia's freight goes to Southeast Asia. We're predominantly an exporting nation, and about, about two-thirds of our freight doesn't really touch the area in which the Suez Canal is. Looking at the data, we send about 28% of the value of Australian imports and exports to destinations around the Suez Canal, and about 14% of the weight of import and exports go through the Suez Canal. So in terms of the average Australian waiting for their, perhaps a scarf arriving from Italy or a bottle of wine arriving from France, I fully expect that we're going to expect some delays. But like I said earlier, the vast majority of our trade does actually go to Eastern Asia. So on the global scale of things, we're pretty lucky. We might get away with this pretty much undisrupted.
Well, fingers crossed. And I do hope they get this sorted out soon. Elizabeth Jackson from Curtin University, thanks very much for joining me on The Money.
Thank you, Richard. A great pleasure.
And if you like your memes, just head to the socials, Instagram and Twitter. There's some great pictures of that ship and some people have been very funny about it. This is The Money with me, Richard Ady, on Radio National and wherever you get your podcasts. And this, well, this woman you know.
People who look at this package today will be under no doubt that we are trying to tilt the playing field towards first home buyers, towards those trying to buy a home or change their home away from the rampant demand we've seen from speculators.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, speaking earlier this week, announcing her government's plan to try to bring down house prices. The Kiwis have an affordability issue that's worse than ours. Actually, it's the worst in the OECD. Brad Olson's a senior economist at the Wellington-based economic consultancy Infometrics.
House prices are spiralling quite fast out of control. The latest figures in New Zealand showing that house prices over the year to February 2021 up 21.5%. You know, just incredibly fast rises. The fear is that they will continue going at that fast clip for a while. At the same time, the amount of stock available in the market for someone to buy down 24% over the last year. So there's not as many houses available, and the houses that are out there are going for a lot more than what people were paying a year before.
So that amount of stock, that's a key part of why it's all going so fast. What are the other drivers?
Yeah, we know at the moment we just simply don't have enough houses in New Zealand. That supply constraint has been a big one. Essentially, it's just so hard to build that hasn't brought more people into the market. Now, housing is a big area of investment in New Zealand. It's you know, way more important than stocks or anything else. But that lack of supply coming through has meant that we've had population growth, quite strong population growth in recent years, and we haven't had the building levels to support that additional population. So everyone around the country is trying to desperately find somewhere to live. Happy to pay through the nose just to have a bit of shelter above their head. In the short term, in the last year since COVID has hit, interest rates have gone through the floor, incredibly low. Cash is easy to find. And so that's also brought a lot of people into the market. People are looking for an investment. They're looking for a way to make money because keeping your cash in the bank hasn't got you a good return. Kiwis are often quite hesitant about the stock market. Therefore, they're looking for property and going, this is where I can make my money. Every man and his dog seeming to jump in at the moment.
So that means that property, residential property, it's kind of a privileged investment, isn't it, in New Zealand? It's sort of worth it for people. What are the conditions that make it that way?
Yeah, it does have some pretty good tax incentives. At the moment, you know, earning a wage, you obviously have to pay tax. Even on some of your investments, you pay different forms of tax. If you buy a house and then sell it, or at least previously when you've sold it after a certain amount of time, all of those capital gains are untaxed. People aren't having to worry about, you know, giving the tax man a few dollars. They keep it all for themselves. So house prices heading higher is because people are heading into the market. They know they can make bank on a house. And that's very much come true in New Zealand over the last year or so. For a lot of people, it's also locking out those at the bottom, though. We know that the home ownership rate in New Zealand continues to fall. People are obviously having to wait a lot longer to get onto the housing ladder because these high house prices are meaning that they're taking longer to save a deposit. It's taking a year longer than it used to. It's gone to about 9 years now that it takes to save a deposit for an average house in New Zealand. And so that's pushing people further into life. It's changing how people are renting and for how long, and also changing what jobs people are able to take and when they're starting to start their families.
So the government that you have over there has unveiled its response to make it less profitable for investors. That's the gist of it. I hear landlords are already complaining. What are the measures, Brad?
Yeah, so the government is looking to screw the scrum away from investors. So there's a few measures. So I said before that most capital gains are untaxed. The government's now made it that if you sell any property within 10 years of buying it, you have to pay tax on those gains. That's up from 5 years previously. Now, because the government wants to have more houses come in as well, they've exempted any new builds from that 10-year selling timeframe. So you can build something new, flick it off. Because you added to supply, you don't have to pay tax on that. Related, and in another way that the government has stung investors, is removing the ability to deduct interest off your taxable income. So what it means is that investors now having to pay interest, they can't write off their interest against their rental income or similar. So they're having basically that their costs of being an investor, a landlord, have gone up. So that's sort of another area that's sort of hitting investors in the pocket.
Will these new rules cause some property investors to back off or to offload or just to be less keen on going into the market?
Yeah, there is a fair bit of talk at the moment from investors about possibly selling out and getting out of the market because things are not quite as easy and possibly of putting up rents and similar. A fair bit of it seems to be a reactive bit of bluster. Rents have been going up in New Zealand quite a bit already recently. So landlords are already extracting sort of the maximum in a sense that a lot of people can afford. But yes, some investors are going to say, look, I've reassessed my numbers. It's not worth it as much to be an investor anymore. There is the feeling that these changes will cool down the housing market a bit, put a bit of a chilling effect on investors, and just meaning that things are moving at a slightly less rapidly changing pace.
I think there's a new $3.8 billion fund and more support for first-time home buyers on the supply side. What sort of price fall is being forecast as a result of all the changes we've been talking about? And what sort of drop do you need over there to make property affordable?
There's a huge amount of uncertainty over just how much of a change these policies will bring. A lot of forecasters and economists expecting that these changes will slow the housing market, but they won't see prices drop. Westpac Bank in New Zealand is expecting house prices could fall 10% over the next 5 or so years, I think it is, because of this policy. So there are probably changes afoot. If we look at the affordability ratios and sort of where house prices would need to be, to get affordability in terms of house price to income multiples back to 5, so you know you're having to spend 5 years worth of income just to buy a house, that would require a 25% fall in house prices in New Zealand at the moment. So a relatively steep decline as people start to sort of think, okay, what am I doing with property? Is it an investment? Is it shelter above people's head? Is it a bit of both?
Yeah, a 25% drop, that would be a big deal. There'd be a lot of pushback on that. Does Jacinda Ardern have the political capital to kind of really get this to work?
Well, one of the big questions is not only is it does she have the political capital, but does the government of the day have the political ability to actually implement these changes? I mean, talk is cheap, and we've done a lot of talking in New Zealand about how bad the housing market is and what we'd like to do about it. The government has been stung in recent times, coming into power in 2017 with a promise to build 100,000 homes over the next decade. They've built, I think, just over 1,000 4 years in. So their ability to execute has been somewhat limited. I think that's why they're looking to try and free up supply. But look, the key point from the political point of view is that although New Zealand is starting to have this conversation about how to fix the housing crisis, I don't know if a 25% drop in house prices is palatable to the country, because that would be a huge change. And after, you know, such a long period of rapid rise over recent years.
Brad, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brad Olson's at Infometrics, an economic consultancy in Wellington. I'm Richard Ady, and on Radio National or wherever you get your podcasts, this is The Money. Last winter, things were a bit grim, so we decided to look at a few industries and see how they were going. Two of them especially had been affected, and they still are. Tourism and hospitality. With JobKeeper finishing, we're going to catch up with a few of the people we spoke to back then. One in hospitality, two in tourism. One big, one small.
My name is Mark Treasure. I'm one of the owners of Miramar Cruises. We are a tourist boat taking passengers up the river to the Lone Pine Koala Sanctuary.
Miramar is a small family business in Brisbane. Four family members, a few staff, two boats.
We feared that without international travellers we would be decimated, as 90% of our customers are international based. That's proven to be dead correct. We've been trying to run on about the 10% domestic market.
Yeah.
And then with lockdowns and borders and things like that, that's just even decimated what we might have had from interstate people, which would be more likely to come on a boat to a koala park because it's something new. To get local domestic staff to do our run is a little bit impossible. A, they could drive there, but B, most people know it already. The main customers we would have would be school children or younger kids with their grandparents on holidays or things like that, younger people that see it. In June, we might have still had two boats, but we sold one. We had two boats running at the peak of our time, a little Wendy 20-seater. We've had to sell that because it was just sitting there doing absolutely nothing. So that boat's gone as well. So we were down to one big boat, our big main boat.
A few minutes' walk from the boat is Brisbane's South Bank. Big convention centre, theatre, art gallery, lots of bars and restaurants. Some of them run by the Mantle Group. Darren Kahn is their area manager.
We were one of Brisbane's first microbreweries. So we've got the microbrewery, the venue's made up of three different parts essentially. So we've got a brewer's pantry, which is a cafe, morning breakfasts, all-day dining for pre- and post-theatre. The restaurant operates 7 days a week.
So that was Darren last winter. How's it going now?
It's been still fairly, you know, compared to what we know South Bank and the cultural centre to be, it's still completely different to normal. Yes, there are shows happening, but I think there's an inkling in people's minds about spending too much time out. I think they would drive to the theatre and leave straight away. Every time a little outbreak occurs, it completely destroys any momentum that we've built from then. So, you know, to give you an example, before Christmas, we were going really well. New Year went really well. January started really well with the school holidays, but then restrictions came in again in the second week of January here in Brisbane, and the mini lockdown completely just pushed restart again. And we're having to build that momentum up again. And probably from now is we're starting to see the momentum building back and getting more confident with people coming out again.
How important has JobKeeper been for Miramar Cruises?
JobKeeper's kept us afloat so that we did have the staff and we were still able to run. I could still offer the trips. Now, it's not to say we ran them as often as we would like, but we were still there running the boat when we had enough customers to do it, so we weren't going backwards. We then chased the domestic market. We got into advertising. We got into the Facebook ads, the Google ads. We were able still to chase this domestic market on a local level. So, of course, JobKeeper kept us going.
With JobKeeper finishing up, what's that going to mean for your business?
Well, it just means that I cannot keep the staff on, and the poor staff who know that and feel bad for me, and I feel bad for them. But, for example, my skipper who's been with us as a trainee, he's been with us for 13 years, he took over the role as the main skipper. He's gone and had to go and get a casual job. Not as a skipper, there's no skipper jobs, but he's a deckhand. That's taken him away from me. My other skipper is deciding to him I'll spend the time to go upgrade his ticket so he might be able to do something. So, in all honesty, I'll be decimated. I don't have a skipper, any skippers left that I can call on to say, oh, we'll run. I now have to rely on them to tell me what days they can work so that I can try and work out a roster to run to Lone Pine.
The hospitality business is less about JobKeeper. Traditionally, it employs a lot of casuals, but losing it will still make a difference.
Across the group, it's quite a large amount. I mean, venue by venue, you might not see it, but in terms of the actual group, yeah, we'll be affected quite heavily in terms of the outlay that will go towards the wages now. You know, we're still at 50% capacities in all of our venues.
So will it mean when JobKeeper ends that you'll be having to let more people go, or will you just find a way of wearing it and hang in?
We need to find a way to make it work. We can't afford to let people go and let it affect our overall product, which is offering the service and the experience of coming to a venue to be able to enjoy themselves. If we let staff go, that's not going to happen, because you know there's lots of things that need to happen for someone to really enjoy themselves. You know, we've got to keep a venue clean and safe. So we need to manage that internally, venue by venue, and how best to make that happen.
Entrada Travel is a much bigger concern. Its chief executive is John Thorburn.
JobKeeper was an absolute lifeline for us, because it's now a year since the restrictions came in place around the borders, and it's just been so critical for us to retain that key capability and the key talent we have in our business. And now, without that JobKeeper assistance, we are faced with inevitably having to make further cuts. And the big concern we have is just the loss of capability for when the recovery happens.
The Australian end of you, and of course you're a trans-Tasman travel business, but the Australian end of it is far north Queensland.
That's right. And prior to the outset of the pandemic, we employed about 230-odd staff up there in Cairns. We're now down actually to around 75. Yep. Through the cuts that we've had to make and some level of attrition. And now that the JobKeeper has finished, we'll be looking at another review to see what else we will need to trim in order to sustain ourselves through the next few months.
Realistically, what sort of percentage do you think you're going to be able to keep?
We're getting down now to almost the minimal viable level of staffing.
So are you going to get through all this, John?
We will survive this, but our big concern is just that the next 9 months or so are going to be the critical ones, where when we do get to recover and get to restart, that will just be so slow, and it will be really challenging to pick up at the pace we need to, because we won't have that talent available. And as you can imagine, with an industry like ours, particularly where you're talking about vessels and diving, there's some very specialist skills, and they're not readily available if they've disappeared and left the town.
When I last spoke to you, John, you were hoping for, at the end of JobKeeper, which at that stage we thought was going to be September, a need for more targeted support for businesses like yours that, I suppose, had a plan and could see their way to being sustainable beyond this. That hasn't happened, although you do now have the flights which start next month, cheaper flights that will get into North Queensland. How much is that going to help?
Oh, we're really grateful for the fact that there is an attempt to stimulate some demand. We welcome that. The practical issue that we see is just having that's going to take some time, and also it's likely to be a little bit constrained, we think, by just that ongoing lack of confidence amongst the consumers. Of course, at the moment, there's a very real risk when people book these types of holidays that they may find themselves on the wrong side of a state border closure, with all the associated headaches that comes with that. So whilst it's a great initiative, the bigger problem that we have is just, as I said before, that capability retention.
Miramar Cruises is tiny compared to Entrada, and Mark Treasure is much less certain about the future.
I'd have to admit to you, every week I change my mind. Every week I have a different scenario. But worst case scenario is just to shut the boat and just leave it and just say, look, we'll survive. All the staff will be off somewhere doing something. It doesn't help us in the future as much as to say, if you stop any business, to start it up again is very difficult. Or I do what I'm trying to do, and I'm going to try and minimise the days we go, try and get one skipper and one deckhand each time we run, just to run the business. I'll be there running it with no pay. My brother will be around there doing his bits, which is the boating bits, no pay. You know, that's what we should be doing. But who knows, if I cannot keep the skippers I have, and I just can't get other skippers to drive a big boat that they've never driven, I'm not going to do that with my million-dollar boat. So you can understand, one minute I'm this way, one minute I'm that way. I really don't know. It's like every week we look at it and think, what should we do?
What would help?
Just some help for minimum staff. You know, like if the government to me is paying $300 to unemployed people, maybe they could have said to me, you know, how many staff do you minimum need to run that boat? And I'd say, look, I need 3 staff. Pay me $300 minimum. If I can put another $300 or $400 towards it, I know it's not up to their wage, but I'm pretty sure that some of them would have still said, yeah, look, that's good. We understand and we can bear through it. I mean, 2 of them are married with kids and houses, and one young fella isn't. But, you know, I think that would have helped. Some sort of incentive to keep them going would have helped.
John Thorburn's firm could do with something similar.
What we would love to be able to do is have some kind of targeted assistance just around key skills and key staff members. So I understand there may not be an appetite to prolong the JobKeeper in its current form, and there'd be reasons for that. But I would have thought some modified version of it that's very targeted towards key skills within our sector, because let's face it, the tourism sector is clearly the one that has suffered the most brutal assault from this pandemic. That would be all we would need, and we're probably not talking cumulatively enormous amounts of money to do that, because it's very targeted.
Right, so in your business, I think you said you've got about 75 still in far north Queensland. How many of them are the key that you absolutely couldn't manage without?
Well, we're now down to the people with, you know, the dive trainers, the skippers, some key compliance type staff with particular skills. So as we start eating into that skill set, that's where we will struggle to climb back out in any kind of speed. So, you know, holding on to that 75 odd staff level that we have now is really our critical mission. And at the moment, unfortunately, we're still burning cash on a weekly basis, because what we have to exist off is a very loyal and supportive local market, but it only goes so far.
Despite that, as you've heard, Entrada says it will be okay. Being big helps. Actually, even being medium-sized helps. Darren Khan.
I'm very confident that we'll be okay. You know, there's been a lot of promising signs. We're doing a lot of work behind the scenes in terms of how we can keep a lot of our staff, how we can attract new staff. And if we can create some professionalism out of getting some new people and getting some people with some passion, then we can definitely make a difference.
Darren Khan from the Mantle Group in Brisbane. And that's it for this week. Just time to say congratulations to The Conversation for 10 years. Well done. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Jerome Commissari. I'm Richard Aidy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.